This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Ithaca, New York boasts an authentic craft beverage experience, tasty farm-to-table culinary adventures, and scenic outdoor recreation among 150 waterfalls. Plan your trip today with help from visitithaca.com.
This is Dana Cowan, host of Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. I've been a part of the HRN community for a couple of years now, and even after all that time, I'm constantly inspired by the incredible voices on our network. Each week, I record my show with a window out onto people eating pizza. Why is that important? Because this is food radio. I am excited to bring the listeners incredible stories from women in hospitality, people who care enormously about food, where it comes from, and the stories behind it. All of us here at HRN make food radio because we love it. This year, HRN is celebrating its 10th anniversary, but we need your support to keep food radio going strong for the next decade. Join the HRN community today by becoming a member. Here's how you do it. You go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and do that right now. You can even show some love for my show by selecting Speaking Broadly in the designation drop-down menu. Thanks for listening to HRN. Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I speak to an extraordinary woman in hospitality about their journey through triumphs and challenges, all the way to the happy, hopefully happy position where they land today. Today, my guest is Marguerite Mariscal, the 30-year-old CEO of Momofuku. I'm sure that doesn't need too much of an introduction, but in case, it is a culinary brand that was founded by the iconoclast Dave Chang. Marguerite started at Momofuku as an intern in 2011 and has quickly risen to the top of the organization. And when I say top, I don't mean like generically the top, like I mean CEO. I guess I said that. Dave is a wild visionary behind the growth and the change at Momofuku and has said that Marguerite has a better sense of the brand than he does, which of course makes me incredibly interested to have her here. Learning Dave speak or understanding what's inside his head is an exciting and I imagine really quite challenging prospect. Welcome, Marguerite.
Thank you.
I'm so happy to have you here. I've known Dave for a really, really long time. So he founded Momofuku, I guess, in 2004. And I still remember going to, you know, sit on a wood chair and eat ramen with him, like really intense in the back. You didn't, you know, you came along a little bit later, but I have to imagine, are you one of the longest running Momofuku?
In the office, yes, but we have a manager at Noodle Bar who's been there for 14 years. We've had a couple of chefs that have been there for 10 plus, so there's a lot of people in that camp.
Okay, so you're not just completely distinguished in that way.
I'm new, you know,
compared to some of them. So why do you think that Dave says that you understand the brand better than he does? And what is that? How does that make you feel?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I agree. I think just I understand the end goal that he wants to achieve, even if it's maybe through a different means or interpretation. But I think we both have a common sense as to the kind of company that we want to run and, you know, kind of where things are going. But I don't know if I can say that I know more than Dave. I think that's
fair. Okay, so what's the end goal?
I think what's interesting about Momo is that it's never been like, you know, be the biggest or the most profitable or open the most restaurants. I think it's always been kind of trying to do things differently. And so you could see that even when Dave, instead of opening another noodle bar in 2004, opened Sambar and then opened Co. And it's kind of been that process for a bit. I would say it used to be very organic based on opportunities, based on what Dave was interested at the time. I wouldn't say that's dramatically changed, but there's definitely more intent as to where we want to go geographically, the kind of concepts we think they're missing in the market. But at the end of the day, it has to be something that's super exciting. Otherwise, it's not worth doing.
Okay, so you're giving me so many openings here. So where are there the holes in the market?
I think Peach Mart is something we just opened at Hudson Yards, and that's something that we've been super excited about for many years and kind of finally found a space to do it. So the idea is how do you make a convenience store but more in line with, you know, the Lawson or 7-Elevens in Japan?
And describe to people what that is.
So that's actual quality food that's produced pretty consistently. There's always like a timestamp of this is when it was produced and this is when it's going to get pulled, as well as they're like impeccably clean. It's like the cleanest bathrooms. And it's just kind of a part of, I guess, daily life in a way that, you know, I would say in the U.S., the convenience store is more like a gas station or not something that's a place you'd go to eat. So we've been playing around with that. I mean, Dave always talks about the best ideas are the things that are the lamest. So 7-Eleven being a great example of that. But same with, we always kind of talk about, you know, Applebee's or these kind of, everyone wants to make a QSR right now. No one wants to make a relatively affordable large restaurant, and kind of mining those as possible ideas, just because at this point, every chef has a, you know, a quick service version of X, and how do you find something that hasn't really been mined yet?
So when I went to Peach Mart, which I loved in Hudson Yards, so if anyone's in Hudson Yards, you can go to Kauai, which is one of the Momonu restaurants that's extraordinary. Next door is Peach Mart. But I got to play a game and I got to win.
Yes.
Now, I never win games. So the idea that I got free food, I like that. And I got to win. So can you just describe like the what you're doing there? I got to roll some dice.
Yes.
They were plastic. So I loved it.
So there's this thing called Shake a Day, which is kind of really informal gambling. So the idea being that you can, once you get to the register, if you roll the dice a certain way, you can get, you know, and every day it changes. We have these different tokens. So whether it's something as simple as a dollar off, or some days it's a bigger prize, like, you know, a free kimbap, a free sandwich, but kind of having, I think what we figured out with Bong Bar, which is a concept that we opened at Time Warner Center, where we actually started out us trying to really make it technologically sophisticated. You know, like you place your order, you get a text message, you can wander around, get called back. What we ended up doing is actually the opposite, like really analog. Like we found that actually calling people's names and then remembering them worked way better than technology. And so I think at Peach Mart, we wanted something similar where how do you make like a loyalty or rewards program that's not Level Up, that's not an app? How do you make something that feels more spontaneous and organic? And given they're both kind of big office environments, we do get a lot of people coming back. So it's fun for first timers, but it's more so, I think, designed around people that come there every day.
Okay, as a first timer, I loved it, and I got a free sandwich.
Yes.
So, like, I didn't get the most minimal version. I felt like that was a pretty great expression of how to get something free, and it also inspired me to spend more money. I'm well, then I think I have to bring a bottle of Somme home with me.
There you go. Perfect.
Which indeed I did. You mentioned technology. I understand that one of your great geniuses at MoMA was like working through technological issues. Is that a passion of yours, or is it also because of what people say that you will do anything? Marguerite succeeds because she will do, well, legal,
yeah,
but
anything. Yeah. I would say, I only in the facet as it's like part of like the consumer's experience. When I started, I did social media because I was the youngest person, and that was kind of like the new scary thing. And then that moved to digital media, which included our websites, which I have redone twice. And then that transformed into working with the tech team on our reservation system, which was something that actually was started in 2008 when we opened Co, just because there wasn't anything out there that could do what we wanted, which was book out those 12 seats at 10 a.m. every day for only 2 weeks in advance. So that was actually something that was built. And then as we grew and added, you know, fried chickens at Noodle Bar or Bosom's at Sambar, the system had to keep growing. And so we revamped that as well. And I think we've gotten to a point in our growth, both you could see this kind of in every capacity where we're trying to not do as many things ourselves in a vacuum, and working with partners who are kind of best in class in those categories and collaborating with them. So we're moving as a company to kind of figure out what's the best path forward. And it's not always doing something, bootstrapped, which is kind of the old Momo way of everything was, as you know, what we could afford or what we could do. I think it's just all part of the user experience and, thinking about a customer's journey from when they go to our website to when they get the bill and just making sure that each of those points are thought of, not just the food, which I think was what Momo used to be known for.
So you took over the social and the website, which, and brand. How did you think about the visuals and expressing tone and Dave-ness through those, words and pictures?
Yeah, I think, so starting obviously with social media and kind of, I think we, I think there's so much what was great about Momo and why I think I was interested in the first place is that I think it's always been a brand since the day it basically opened. And I started in 2011 when the first issue of Lucky Peach had come out. They literally opened in Australia the week that I started. So I was like the only person in the office for a while. I think it's kind of whether it's the band photo in Noodle Bar or the patron saint of like McEnroe at Sambar in the playlist.
John McEnroe, yeah. Poster of him in the bar.
And so, yeah, if we always had these kind of patron saints in each of the locations and, the playlists, which Dave's, meticulously thought through, there was always like a lot of content there, like a more rounded sense, I think, than just the food. And so that was kind of, how do you take that and apply that to whether it's so I launched the Instagram. We started doing a Tumblr. It was like right when I think restaurants started to realize they could do their own marketing and PR in a way that was kind of unavailable prior to that. So we started hiring design interns to then create the assets that then were used on these different pieces. So it kind of like naturally snowballed. It's like if you build it, I think of it better than if you build it, it will come. It's like a goldfish that almost like grows the size of its fish tank. It's like once you start having these different means of communication, you just kind of need to keep feeding it in some way. And so that meant redoing the website, that meant hiring these designers. And when I started, there wasn't really, I think, anyone who was focused on design. It was kind of always an afterthought. I would say as a company, it's always like function over form. And so I remember when I can't remember if I was still an intern, but I updated the menus for the websites for all the restaurants. And I remember I was opened up Noodle Bar's menu. And so Momo's font used to always be Century Gothic on everything. And I opened up their menu and it was like Myriad Pro, which is the font that if your computer doesn't have the right font, it defaults to. So for like, God knows how long, that's just like what was happening. And that's something obviously that like I care infinitely about, but clearly, no one else does.
Not everyone is like, oh my God, the font. Yeah. I really identify with that.
So I basically just took like, once again, just like snowball, like started just absorbing that stuff into my bucket as well. It was a very like organic process, not anything deliberate.
That notion of a fully formed brand, which certainly we weren't talking about brands in the same way back in 2004. Nobody would have said that about Dave. And certainly not at Sambar where, he had one idea and then he's going to do a Korean burrito. And then it's like, oh my God, I built this line wrong and this whole business is wrong and this is wrong. And like it was, I don't think he was thinking about it that way, but is what you're saying that he infused every project with so much personality that there was dimensionality to everything and therefore it was a brand? Like, is that your definition of brand?
Yeah, I guess I think everything was really thoughtful. Like, we always talk about how when Sambar opened, probably not contributing to its success, it only served like Dr. Pepper and Diet Dr. Pepper and like OB beer and like Pellegrino. And it was like, that was a very conscious choice made. So I would say everything was very intentional. I agree. I don't think anyone would necessarily look at it and say that if it was a brand, it was a very like interesting brand of these different factors. But I would say everything was thought through. And, you know, I think also something core to the brand is just the ability to, as you said, like if it doesn't work, like change it. So whenever we do orientation for new employees, we always talk about how like if this restaurant looks the way that it does now in a year, we've all failed because it needs to be a living, breathing thing that reacts to the people that want to come here, you know, the environment. And so, you know, I think that that kind of acceptance of change and that kind of willingness also, you know, for example, like, and things have completely changed, but, you know, at the time having the statement of there are no vegetarian options, all of that stuff, like those are all very conscious choices to kind of define your restaurant. And, you know, and once again, conscious choices to then undo those decisions and evolve and grow as a company.
I wonder about some of those things because Dave was so definitive. You know, he was so determined to have a place that was consistent. Like, and no, if you want to have all vegetables, like this isn't your place. But it's the times that have changed, or Dave has mellowed, or
I think it's a big combo of things. I think part of it is, you know, it's almost like when like to do what. This is my personal opinion, to do what Dave did, you almost had to swing to the other side of the pendulum. Like, to make Coco, you had to do away with backs on seats, no white tablecloth, no sommelier. It's exactly what it is. There's no substitutions, because that was the statement that it was the complete opposite of the norm. And if he just did one of those things, no one would have paid attention. It wouldn't have actually like changed, I think, how people view fine dining and that you can have quality food at what I perceive as a affordable price or value for what it's charged. And then I think once you do that, then you can kind of start, you can actually have nuance and you can start saying, okay, well, what do we do just because that's how we did it before? What do we do because it matters to us versus this kind of decision you made prior? So when we redid Co and moved it to Extra Place, that was kind of the constant conversation. Like, is having backless stools something we care about? Or is that just was a symptom of we had no money and the space was tight and you know, that's what we had at Noodle Bar. So, you know, I think that it's that comboed with I think some of it's maturity and just not having to be being right, being less important than people enjoying the restaurant. And I think that's something that we talk a lot about recently is just making sure, you know, we now have comment cards at a lot of our restaurants, which is like insane for anyone who used to go to.
I mean, no one can imagine how shocking that is. I mean, and just knowing the evolution, but that's actually
it's crazy. Incredible. And, you know, and I think we look at all of it as just data points, right? It's like you're not going to make decisions based purely on Yelp. You're not going to make decisions purely based on a comment card. But, you know, it's kind of silly to not have those data points and compare them with what is the chef thinking? What are we seeing when people are eating the food? You know, it's kind of a giant blind spot. So that's definitely, I would say, maturity in some ways of being able to take those responses, but also just, you know, I think the climate has changed. And I think in general, there's almost like a rejection of what, you know, communal seating and backless stools and being treated in a way that I think, you know, was kind of in vogue for a while. And I think, you know, and it almost, as I said, was a reaction to the previous time. Like, you almost had to like ebb and flow into this. But I think we're kind of now out of it in a way, and people want to choose what they're eating, and people want to, you know, not be uncomfortable, and that's okay too.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That's our job. Yeah.
And when you talk about these things, a lot of it does originate with Dave. Like, he has such a strong vision, but you do as well. And clearly, he respects you immensely. I mean, your name has come up in our conversations for so many years, which, you know, of course made me curious to meet you, but also to understand the role that you feel that you play. You know, is it adding the questions? Is it, you know, pushing back? Is it forwarding, you know, like moving forward? Like, how do you see your role now as CEO, or over the last few years, because it's evolved, right? I mean, you were chief of staff, so
I think it's a combo. I think it's having conversations. I think it's I don't know if this is just my upbringing or what, but I feel like even when I was in, you know, I don't know, digital media manager, I felt very comfortable saying, well, like, well, why do we do it this way? Like, you know, and I think it's very easy to, when you work at a big company or what we now is a big company, to just kind of do things based on that's how we've always done it. And I think the beauty of Momofuku in general is the ability to kind of question everything. And just because, you know, we, like, I always use Noodle Bar as a great example. At 171, you know, Chef Tony Kim, he basically changed the way that we do the pork buns. And there's nothing sacred. There's no holy cow. There's no thing that is untouchable.
Wait, that's amazing. Let's go back. So let's just talk about the history of the pork bun.
Yeah.
So, and
it's really, I think it's fascinating. It's, you know, we always serve this pork bun, which was kind of the core, I would say. And, you know, was something that was, you could get at Sambar, you could get at Ma Pastry, you could get everywhere.
And describe it a little bit, because I think people have had bad versions of it because
yes.
It's been replicated so many places. So if you haven't had the Momo version, it's been bastardized a little, but do you want to just describe
sure.
like what that original
yeah so was? It was two pieces of pork belly that were stacked in a like a Peking duck bun or also a Taiwanese bun and with hoisin sauce and pickles and pickled cucumbers, and it was always these kind of like it's super fatty, super squishy, and you know, I think you could say that every Momo restaurant you know, really was heavy on pork belly, and at the time that was actually like a contrarian thing and it was cheap, which is why we used it. And then as pork belly kind of became more in vogue, the price has gone up, and you know, now it's almost a luxury product as opposed to something that intentionally was used because it was cheap. And also I would say, you know, once again, changing tastes, at least in my personal opinion, I think people are less looking for like super fatty, heavy than they were before. So, and plus the way that it's done, maybe this is getting too chefy, but it's, there's a lot of waste that comes out of it because you're trimming these things down. You know, you don't want any piece to be too fatty or too lean. So you're kind of getting this perfect, area. And so, and Noodle Bar, which does insane volume, it's like everything you can do to make it more efficient, but while improving quality is a decision to make, and never doing anything for the sake of efficiency, but if there's ways that we can produce something we think is better. So Tony started doing this thing where he basically started rolling the pork belly, so you got like an even distribution of the fat and the leaner parts across it. And so then it became just slicing it, and then they started searing it on the plancha, so it got some crispiness in addition to like the really fattiness, which I personally think is better. And it's more efficient, and it makes a more consistent product. So, you know, things like that, you know, we still have people that take a photo of it and say like, oh, never change, you know, like, this is great. And it's like, no, this is like literally like in this evolution. And same with the broth that we do at Noodle Bar, that's gone through all these iterations and how people's tastes have changed in terms of, it used to be like super smoky, Benton's, fatty. Now it's a little cleaner and, you know.
So let's hold there for a second. So it's the original ramen
yes,
broth
yes.
that you're talking about. And it was like the Benton's is an Allen Benton
yes.
Ham. Is it a ham or is it
a bacon slab that he produces,
slab,
but smoked and super, super flavorful. And so, you know, I think I think what's great is, you know, you had that transition. And then at Time Warner Center, we just opened, we finally kind of felt comfortable around the idea of expanding Noodle Bars. And but for us to do that, we knew we couldn't copy and paste what we did in the East Village because it's just so singular to itself. And so we started actually producing at Time Warner Center all of our own dough. So in the same way that, as you said, you can go to Portland, Maine or Portland, Oregon and get a pork belly bun that is the same bun essentially, you know, how can you do it differently? How could you actually offer something? So doing it ourselves means we can do stuffed buns, we can do split tops, we can do sliders, we can kind of change the mode in which you're eating these things. So all's to say, you know, I think we're constantly trying to improve and get better and look at, you know, that's something I've always said is that if you were to drop the design of Noodle Bar in the East Village in Portland, Maine, there's a place that looks exactly like it right now. And it's like, why would anyone think this is new or interesting? And they've already had a pork belly bun at some other place down the street. So you have to look at like who's around you, what are they doing? And if you want to continue to actually offer something compelling and unique, not rest on the idea that we're who we are or someone's heard of our name. So that's been a process, and we're opening in LA later this year. So like we're finally, I think, at a place where we feel like we have a product that's like a competitive product regardless of our name. You know, it could be blah, 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 noodle bar, and I think it's up there.
So you have a restaurant in LA because you have Major Domo, mm-hmm. but you're saying you're expanding noodle bars
yes.
out of New York City to mm-hmm. have more noodle bars. The notion of expansion, I'm curious your, you know, point of view. If the aesthetic, the original aesthetic, was each place unto itself and very edgy and indie. When you have noodle bars on two coasts, and you replicate Peach Marts, and you have CPG, you have consumer packaged goods, like selling the Somm sauce. What's your point of view on that original identity and what it transforms into?
It's a good question. I think for me, I think one, you know, I think... coolness is relative, and I think that, you know, when Noodle Bar's gonna be 15 years old in August, and I think at a certain point it's like you have to grow up a little bit, and that being cool is not the top priority, and I think that speaks to what we just talked about with having backs on chairs and you know, being hospitable and all these things, and I think for us it's still maintaining that level of originality in all these spaces. So for example, for these noodle bars, you know, Time Warner Center has these vertical spits, which are very much a reaction to its environment, and has a unique offering. Like the chicken ramen at Time Warner Center, it comes off of this vertical spit. So it's something that you could not offer downtown. And in LA, we're going to have a unique cooking element as well that's tethered to our relationship with LA. And I think by bringing the dough production in-house and having that visible creation of these products there, it's like, how do you grow but make sure that you're not, it's not cookie cutter, it's not inhuman, like you have to keep that element, and we don't have all the answers, like, you know, is that good enough, is that enough, we'll find out. And as I said, if it's not there when we open, it will be there here. But it's just continuously figuring out how can you offer something. And I think, you know, Major Domo is such a good example of entering, you know, LA in a way that felt respectful to LA and felt intentional. And I think we all, you know, were like nervous to do it, right? Because you didn't want to kind of mail it in or offer, you know, the same. If we offered pork buns and ramen like we did at 171 as our first restaurant in LA, I don't know if it would work.
171 being a noodle bar.
Yeah.
Which maybe not our
Yeah.
So I'm curious about the innovation. It sounds decentralized, but I also know that Dave, like when I was in LA at Major Domo, there he was in the kitchen working with the chef. So do the two of you independently go around? Do you weigh in on food innovation? Because I know I've just, you know, stalking you.
Yeah.
You've been in Australia. You've been in LA. You've been at each of the restaurants. Do you weigh in on food? Hospitality,
totally.
Vision.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason Dave and I work well together is I think we have our respective strengths. Like, you know, at the end of the day, I'm going to always defer to Dave on everything related to culinary. But I think there's two points. I think one is, you know, I think food at this point, it's silly to think that it's just the way that it tastes. For example, like how you're serving it, what are you calling it on the menu? Those are all things that Dave and I talk about all the time, in making sure that, you know, I think plate, you know, whether it's, so I work on the menus, the plateware, all of the things around it, and helping, I would say, more so than the actual dishes, just constructing with Dave and whatever the local team is, what is the kind of, we always talk about the idea of a sandbox, and it's like, what does this restaurant operate within? So, you know, what are the rules around the sections? What are the rules around creativity? Because I think, you know, and they, perfect example of that is when we opened in Sydney, we opened this restaurant called Seobo, and it's a tasting menu restaurant in a casino in Sydney, and it's twice won best restaurant in Australia with two different chefs, which is like insane. And so when they were doing the menu, there's this whiteboard that I have a photo of that, you know, is, and there's a lot of whiteboarding happening at all times at Mofugu. And it basically is just a list of what are we not going to do? We're not going to use any seafood that's not from Australia. We're not going to, you know, plate things with swooshes, which at the time was like the hot, you know, way of doing it. We were going to use as much as possible indigenous ingredients like wattle seed, which were not perceived as being very cool at the time. And, you know, really focused in on how can you make this the best restaurant, and the way that you can do that is almost by like limiting yourselves. I think Momo had years and years where we didn't have to put the limitations on ourselves. Like money did that, time did that, you know, the amount of AC did that. And we opened in Australia in this like beautiful space with this gorgeous kitchen. And it was almost like the only way that we could keep what made Co good was to then limit ourselves and put these restrictions on. So whenever we're opening a new restaurant, we're always kind of talking about, and it's very internal, it's not for guests, but just kind of for us to continue to be creative, you almost have to carve out what you can and cannot do. Like, you know, the thing where it's like, try making something with like the 6-pack of crayons as opposed to like the 64, you're probably going to get something better. So I work with the restaurants on that kind of stuff, just so that we're all kind of working off the same template, which is what allows, I think, to have this kind of diversified or decentralized creativity. And so that's something that Dave is incredible at, is working with different chefs and, you know, figuring out, because each of them have their own perspective. And, I think Momofuku restaurants at this point are really like, it's, you know, kind of Momofuku meets this chef's personal experience or background, and that's what the product is. So Joe at Akawi is a perfect example, or Paula in Toronto is really like, you know, it's not Dave's food. It's kind of their food through the lens and kind of restrictions placed by Momofuku. And so I think that allows for each restaurant to kind of have its own pulse and its own hub of creativity. And I think what's also cool is that it also is very you know, non-denominational. So like Bing, which started at Major Domo, which is kind of a Bing is bread in Chinese, and it's kind of this flatbread.
It's so good. Those Bings,
it's insane.
Are so good.
Yeah.
And then the add-ons. I mean, there's a caviar and a hoisin, and
it's phenomenal. So, yeah, they're so good. So that started out
definitely run down walk food.
Yeah, R&D for Domo. And then, you know, Dave, as he was talking to the different chefs, you know, kind of shared the technique. And then that basically turned up in Toronto as something made with like a local cornmeal. So it almost has more of like, it's so good. You know, a very different kind of like Johnny Cake-esque flavor to it. And then you have, that's actually was the original inspiration for the bread that we do at Bong Bar, which is the to-go counter next to Time Warner Center, where it's thinned out. And so each chef kind of can take it and then do something with the idea. So it's almost kind of like, you know, it's a concept, and then each person is responsible for like what makes sense in their restaurant. Does this make any sense at all? And if it does, then what do I need to do to make it make sense here? So it's kind of this like, and we have all these internal systems, like ideas at emails, where basically it goes to everyone in the company. And it's like if you put a new dish on the menu, and it has logs of failure, potential criticisms, and kind of allows there to be a dialogue. And that dialogue is not top down from Dave. It's one chef to another. So that's kind of helped, I would say, keep all these, you know, it's almost like spinning multiple plates, where it's like if there was one person doing it, you'd never have the level of innovation or creativity at the local restaurant level. But by everyone kind of working independently and together, you can have that going without there being one person responsible for it, which I think is the difference between how we operate and maybe some other restaurant groups.
I work a lot with Dig In, and we try to resolve that notion of creativity in each of the restaurants, because at each Dig-In, even though like it's planches and it's vegetables and in many cases it's bowls of food, we respond to the farms, right? If someone has like extra shishito peppers, you know, one of the restaurants will take them and they can make whatever they want. But it's always, it's like listening to you talk about that is such an interesting solution to how do you share the knowledge. Like if someone does an amazing dish, you know, downtown, how does uptown learn about that and learn from it? And how is it not lost?
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And how is it captured?
Totally. And that's like, you know, I think we are lucky in that we had some systems that were set up forever ago that, as we've expanded, have only gotten more useful. But I think also as we grow as a company and, you know, open more disparate locations, it's almost you need to double down on those systems. And, you know, we have an internal like portal that, you know, we have daily logs of service and all these different pieces that just trying to make sure that, as you said, nothing gets lost and that there's just continuous communication while empowering the restaurants to kind of resolve things themselves. And it's always this kind of push-pull that, you know, and I think it's the same thing with everything where it's an ebb and a flow, right? Where you go through periods where certain restaurants are kind of, they're grooving, they're going. And then, you know, you know, whether they're launching a new meal period or they have a new large format. And then, you know, the home base office team will come in, advise, help build that out. So it's kind of like at any given point, you kind of have everyone in a different place.
We're going to take a break. I don't want to stop the conversation. The large format in the various restaurants, I think, is fascinating. I mean, Dave obviously pioneered a version of it at Sambar with the Bosom, which again is now copied. I mean, he copied it, but
yeah.
It's copied.
Yeah, exactly. That's worth noting.
Okay, yeah, exactly. To be fair, he didn't invent it. But the large format and my experience of large format, you can tell I go to a lot of Momo restaurants, is impressive in their difference, but also their festiveness and the way that they intersect, you know, with this moment in time, which sharing and celebrating at the table is so valuable. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the intersection of Momo and trends like food waste, but also we're going to find out a little bit about Marguerite's past, which you're really going to want to hear about because, in fact, we haven't talked about it yet, but Marguerite is food royalty. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Ithaca. Located in New York's Finger Lakes region, Ithaca boasts an authentic craft beverage experience, tasty farm-to-table culinary adventures, and scenic outdoor recreation. As the saying goes, Ithaca is gorgeous. The city is home to 150 waterfalls and gorges sprinkled through its downtown and sloping hillsides. State parks and acres of natural lands offer outdoor recreation for every level of enthusiast. Come stroll among the cool ravines, scenic hiking trails, and natural vistas. Ithaca is home to Ivy League Cornell University and Ithaca College, resulting in an influx of new cultures, new tastes, and new energy every year. There's so much to explore, from art galleries and museums to unique attractions like the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Ithaca sits at the heart of a blossoming heritage and craft cider industry. Some of these delicious ciders can be bought in market, but many of the most unique varieties can only be experienced with a visit to Ithaca and this great cider region. Go to visitithaca.com to get inspired and plan your trip today.
Welcome back. This is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly. My guest today is Marguerite Mariscal, the CEO of Momofuku. Hey, Marguerite, we've been talking about all these amazing, the development of dishes at Momo. And during the break, you were saying how in Vegas, where people don't plan so far ahead, some of the dishes that we know and love that are large format and have to be ordered ahead, like you do it differently there.
Yeah. I think just like as we go into new markets and just making sure that we're like planning not just the food, but also like how we're serving it, what we're calling things, et cetera, to be responsive to the environment.
But part of it was that your role is to say, why?
Yeah. And I like sometimes it's like things like, I mean, the example that I always give is the backs on chairs where, you know, whenever we'd open a new restaurant, everyone would just order the same chair as if it's like, you know, default to us. And it's like, you know, that was purchased because we had to, right? Like no one actively chose plywood at, you know, the original noodle bar at 163. It just, that's what made sense. And so just making sure that we're like actively making decisions. And, you know, I think another one is, which is like, you know, uncool potentially is, you know, we used to never participate in things like Restaurant Week or all these different initiatives. And the idea was kind of like, you know, we're above that, you know. And I think that, like, as we've grown, it's like someone who's able to say, you know, well, why don't we do it? Like, is there a real reason? Is it just annoying? Do people like it? You know, I think just not treating anything as if it's like, you know, written in pen in the Momo book and that everything is constantly being considered and reevaluated based on like the current circumstances of where we are.
So I want to talk about your past. You went to Momo in 2011 as an intern, but it wasn't your first experience with food. It seems, and there may indeed have been all kinds of jobs like babysitting and other things along the way, but you worked for your uncle in Amagansett at a farm stand. That was one job, but you come from a line of Zabars, right? Your great-grandfather, Louis Zabar, founded the Upper West Side Emporium, which is very close to my house, I must say, and I was there yesterday and got herring and cream, and prosciutto and melon, but and no smoked salmon, for which Zabar's is justly famous. But your great grandfather and then your mother's father was Stanley, one of the three who really founded and created this emporium that succeeded because of innovation, because of marketing, because of they just completely changed the way that people thought about, like, what's a Jewish deli? And it started small, and then they took over practically an entire block. And I don't want to assume that it's in your blood, but somewhere there is, like, some genetic matter that has been in the food business for a long time. What do you take away from your family history that you feel like you bring to Momo?
Yeah. I mean, I worked as a cashier at Zabar's for some summers, and as you said, I worked for my uncle at the farmer's market he was running. I mean, I think definitely like working hard is something that, you know, when you're working for your family, it's hard to not. And I think that was instilled in me. And then I also think, I talked to Dave a lot about the fact Dave also comes from a family business, not, I mean, some in food and some out. And I think that there's kind of a way that you operate when you have a family business and that you have to make really long-term decisions because it's, at the end of the day, you know, a reflection on you and your values, really. So that's how I perceive it. So, you know, the way that I look at Momofuku is very similar in that it's, you know, in it for the long haul and kind of taking care of people that have been employees. I mean, Zabar's has employees that have worked there for 30, you know, plus years, and we're just like a baby comparative. I think Zabar's is 80 plus right now. So kind of seeing that and seeing how it evolved, and I think you're very right in that, like e-commerce, for example, like totally changed the game for Zabar's. You know, it used to be everyone's like, oh, I miss it. And now all of a sudden it can be delivered to your door in 2 days. So, and I think that they've always kind of been at the forefront of that and just, you know, growing, but at the same time, not growing in a way, you know, they've had offers obviously to like license things and open in Japan and do all these different things that they've always said no to just because at the end of the day, it's their name, it's their product, and that's the most important thing. So I'm sure there's like a value set that I inherited from growing up in that. And just like, you know, Dave and I always talk about it, just that like every single thing is, there's no like off switch. It's just like constant inundation of talking about business and all of the things interconnected, and I'm sure that has negatively impacted me and that I feel the same way now about both Momo and obviously to some degree Zabar's as well. So
now your grandfather was on the finance side, but his brother Saul, I think, was a famous taster, like,
yeah,
a massive
cupping and coffee and going to Acme and, you know, checking the fish and all of that. Yeah, my grandfather was a lawyer and then started working at Zabar's. So he has been more, I guess, involved in like the e-commerce and, you know, systems and that. And Eli is like incredible and, you know, does everything you could possibly imagine.
But was tasting a big part of family history?
I mean, I think in your eating. Family. More so than tasting, I think. You know, we just have, you know, I see everyone very often. Everyone lives within like 10 blocks on the Upper West Side. So there's a lot of that. And, you know, I think just kind of, it was only when I went to college that I realized that my upbringing was not normal and that we would like, you know, we'd go to Flushing on the way. My parents have a house in East Hampton, and we would always stop on the way out. Or my dad's an architect, and so he has projects around New York. So he would, you know, be at a project in Sunset Park and scope out a place that we would then go on the weekend. So everything pretty much revolves around food to some degree. So I think, you know, I got to college and realized that not everyone spent all of their time thinking about and eating. So,
but it's also true that you're, well, obviously you just said your dad's an architect and your mother is in the arts. So she elected to not be in the family business, and you're not in the family business, but you're in the business of the family. Did it ever occur to you to not go in that direction?
It's funny. I mean, I really did not think that I wanted to be, involved in food when I was going through school. I did more so like internships at like NPR and the Sundance Channel and that kind of stuff, and more, I guess, like brand centric stuff. And it's funny, with any family business, you know, I think my mom always talks about when she was growing up that, you know, everyone was like, don't go into retail, it's a horrible business. You know, like my grandfather was like, you have to work Christmas and you work, you know, Hanukkah, and just don't do it. And then I think, you know, most of my cousins have kind of ended up, whether it's like going to Cornell Hospitality School or working for their family, or, you know, everyone kind of, I think, has ultimately gotten sucked back in. But it was definitely not something that I ever approached. You know, I think the fact that I didn't go to hospitality school, I think what's interesting is that momofuku, I think, is the thing that got me, less so restaurants or food.
Right. So like, it's not that you went just to any restaurant group. I mean, you went to a very particular place. I read this beautiful quote about how your family like changed the world. And I mean, in a particular way. And it reminded me of Dave and Momo a lot, which is that they looked at ghettoized Jewish and Italian foods and realized that they could appeal to everyone along with the European imports. And that notion of, you know, taking something that is discarded or not respected as much and then, you know, repackaging it and showing its value. And value is a huge Zabar's proposition. I mean, they love underselling. I wonder, how do you bring that underselling attitude to Momo?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think, you know, Dave and I always talk about how food is the gateway in a lot of ways to education and to even just mutual understanding amongst people. And it's something that we talk about all the time, you know, especially with just opening Kawi and doing kimbap, which people, I think, have historically equated with being a cheap snack.
And just describe what that is.
Yeah, sorry. So it's basically ingredients, usually typically cooked ingredients, wrapped in rice and then seaweed. So similar to like a maki roll in Japan, but distinctive in that how the rice is seasoned is different, and the seaweed used is different, so they're not at all the same things. And, you know, I think that it's interesting almost in that, like, some of the critique we get are from people that are actually really familiar with kimbap, not so much a population that's unfamiliar, because they have a notion in their head of what the cost should be. And so I think that's something that, you know, we're very conscious of and making sure that we're addressing. And, you know, I think that's true for everything we do, is kind of how do you present something in a way? And that goes back to what I was talking about with what are you calling it? How is it being packaged? You know, one of the kimbaps that Joe serves is wrapped in this like kind of beautiful leaf. And it's kind of, how do you kind of change the perception of how people see something? And a lot of times it's more than just the taste, it's everything around it. But yeah, no, I think that's very, I will share that with my grandfather. It's a nice quote.
Do you feel that it was that family background that allowed you as an intern? Because you mentioned it a little bit at the beginning of the show. Like, you know, you ended up a little ballsier than most, because like you have been at the table with these people who are discussing, I'm not saying arguing, but like we're all, you know.
Yeah, it's probably more arguing than not. Yeah, I don't know. I think I would never consciously I never consciously thought that. I think it's that. I think it's also just, you know, like, I think the gift that my schooling gave me is just, like, I think at Dalton, they just instilled in you to, like, always have an opinion. And
Dalton, you know, was high school.
Yeah, like, less so that it mattered if it was right. And so, you know, I think that I have just always felt, or maybe it's, I don't know, maybe this is wrong, but I understood what the end goal was. So if something was not driving with what that was, I felt that I was in the right to call it out because
Feel like it's more personal. It's not actually that you, like, probably ate caviar for lunch because you had the highest caviar volume sales in New York City. Okay, so we're still running out of time. I'm going to rush you here. You need to teach me something.
Oh, yeah.
So what are you going to teach me?
I was going to teach you, inspired by Priya and some other people, how to clean white sneakers.
Oh, wow.
And it's a multi-step process.
Okay, I need to know. And you're wearing white sneakers and I'm wearing blue sneakers. So I don't know if it works for blue ones, but let's see what happens with white.
I think it works for all sneakers. I think just the intensity and, you know, attention on a white sneaker is more. But so it's a three-step process. So it's you start by just, like, wiping off the normal dirt, but just, you know, with a paper towel wetted. Then you have to get a Mr. Clean magic eraser, which is the greatest thing that's ever been invented. I had a professor at Bowdoin who said the only two products that have ever been better than advertised is the iPhone and Mr. Clean magic eraser. And wow. It is beyond true. So that you use on the base, because it's not leather. So you can, like, really get in there. And then, the third step is ivory soap. I don't know why it's ivory soap, but that's what, brand loyal. And you use that with a, washcloth or, like, a t-shirt, and that's what you use on the leather. So it's, like, a very,
it's leather only.
Yeah. Well, that's the hardest. And you can't use the Mr. Clean on the leather because of, like, the micro, you know, abrasion stuff. So, you know, you just gotta.
Okay, so in my case, I'd have to go buy a pair of sneakers to make them dirty.
I think you need white sneakers. I think that's part of.
Well, that's part of what?
I don't know.
It could be my new brand identity.
Exactly.
Given to me by one of the brand experts of America. Thank you very much, Marguerite. Okay, and last question of the show. Pay it forward to some woman in hospitality, someone who you admire who doesn't really get the recognition that she deserves.
So I have three people, if that's okay. We're running out of time. So when I started at Momo, I think what's really interesting is as I've done more of these interviews, we have a staff right now that, you know, are a lot of our department heads and Joe at Hudson Yards, are women. And I think that, like, people are unjustly giving me credit for that. And I think when I started at Momo, all the department heads were women. And so the executive team was this group of, like, incredible people. And I'm sure that had some bearing on my ability to think that this was possible. And so those three people were EJ Song, who moved back to Seattle, but has subsequently worked as the director of operations at a bunch of places. She worked at Whole Foods. She just worked at WeWork. Is moving back to Seattle. Sue Chan, who now has her own agency, Care of Chan, who did branding and PR and marketing. And then Alex Pamoulier, who moved also to Seattle and is currently the head of finance for Sea Creatures, which is that, Walrus and the Carpenter, Whale Winds, and all of those properties.
So, the Rene Erickson restaurants in Seattle. Fantastic.
So anyway, but I just, you know, I think that probably very unconsciously had some effect on me for my time at MoMA.
Right. So those women actually ran the entire MoMA empire at the time. It's changed over time, and you've risen from intern to CEO. Well, that's what we have time for. Thank you so much for coming on Speaking Broadly. If people want to find you, where do they find you?
Oh, my God. I don't know.
Instagram.
On Instagram, yeah. I don't know, mostly just Momofuku all the time. Probably somewhere at some Momofuku restaurant if you want to find it.
At Momo Long Play. At Momo Long Play on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And you know where to find me at Speaking Broadly. If you listened and loved this show, please go to Apple Podcast, rate, review, come back, send me emails. Actually, I want to start a letter writing campaign because, yes, the last time I came to Heritage, there was a letter waiting for me, and it was my happiest moment because I love mail. And so big shout out to my one letter writer. And thanks to Matt Patterson, engineer par excellence. And Nina, welcome back. I missed you in Israel, and I'm so glad you're here co-producing with me today. That's it for today. Enjoy your week, and we'll be back at it next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.